Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step three, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step four, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Chronicles, where today we're going to be talking all about Kim by Rudyard Kipling. Now, this is the first Kipling novel that we've covered so far on Chronicles, and I'm very excited about it. It's a pleasure to talk about the most famous Indian author of all time, so it should be a damn good show. So let's talk a little bit, shall we, about Rudyard Kipling before we get into the actual novel. So Kipling was born in Bombay in 1865. Now, Rudyard Kipling's father was quite a remarkable man in his own right as well. In 1865, the year of Kipling's birth, Kipling being born right at the end of the year on December 30th. So Kipling comes along shortly after his father's move to Bombay. And there he becomes a professor at the local school of art and industry, as a professor of architectural sculptures, and so was a man very much bound in an intellectual understanding of the Orient, of India, of its cultures and traditions and its forms of art. And obviously all of this would be something that Kipling would absolutely inherit from his own father as well. And so Kipling lived by all accounts, a very happy, somewhat spoilt, but very loving life in those early years. But there was a spout of tragedy in his life not long after, which is where, as was very customary for the time, it was decided that Kipling would go back to England, or to England for the first time in his case, to the motherland of the empire. And he would actually have some of his important early formative years living in England, so we can actually see his roots, who he is as an Englishman, and what that part of his identity is all about, and what the heart of empire, what it's all pumping, really. And so he goes back with his sister, and actually in this time he ends up staying with a couple. The gentleman is quite good. I believe he was ex-Navy, but the woman of the house was a deeply evangelical and very abusive, very manipulative woman. And this left Kipling someone who never could quite let his guard down around adults and grown-ups. What Kipling much preferred, and the company that he was most at ease with, was children. Now, Rudyard Kipling absolutely adored children, hence why Kim and the Jungle Book and the Just So stories are all dedicated towards children as their primary audience. He loved them immensely, and he cared deeply about their emotional well-being and their growth into adulthood so that they could become moral and well-rounded people. serving higher goods, and for Kipling, one of those, the highest goods in the world at that time was the British Empire. But after many of these years of torment back in England, in staying with that couple that he stayed with in what he termed the House of Desolation, eventually, just before he turned 17, Kipling returned to India. And this gave him a chance to basically begin to see the country through adult eyes, through the eyes of a young man, and also someone who has experienced India first as a child and then experienced England. And make no bones about it, despite the personal experiences that Kipling had had living under the roof with those two people, that doesn't take away from the fact that Rudyard Kipling absolutely adored England, of course. It was a very, very special place to him, and really a love that permeates just as deeply through his writing and his work and through his achievements in life, as does his obvious love of India as well. And also what we see in this, with this man who strides two separate worlds between loyalty to England and just genuine love of the Orient and its culture and its landscape. We see very much those themes coming through very, very strongly in the novel of Kim, which we'll get into in just a bit. Most of what we understand about Rudyard Kipling and what he felt was important in life is most crucially, obviously, from his actual literature and what he put to the page, but also through his letters and his autobiography that was actually unfinished at the time of his death at the age of 70 in 1936, I believe it was. And of course, through his public speaking engagements, where he's often speaking from a script, but he hated interviews. There's one particular speech that he gave actually on St. George's Day at the Royal Society of St. George back in 1920. And that entire speech is one of the best things I've ever read. His comprehension and the level of knowledge that he has about England and its history and how it was changed over the years by each basically just foreign force that tried to bend the English to their will and make them something that they weren't, and how the English basically just resisted them and took the things that they liked and dismissed the things that they didn't. It's a fantastic speech, and I've got a way to actually incorporate it in to another Chronicles in the future, but that's for another time. In the meantime, I think that we've spoken enough at the beginning, so without further ado, let's talk about the actual story of Kim, what goes on in it, and then we can get to analysing this classic tale. Our story takes place in those years of imperial confidence, in the final few decades of the 19th century in the British Raj, the jewel in the crown of the British Empire. On the chaotic streets of Lahore, a feral young lad spends his days as a child at play. He sat, in defiance of municipal orders, astride the gun Zamzamar on her brick platform opposite the old Ajib Gher. The Wonder House, as the natives called the Lahore Museum, who hold Zamzamar, that fire-breathing dragon, hold the Punjab, for the great green bronze piece is always first of the conqueror's loot. The boy is Kimball O'Hara, son of Kimball O'Hara, but known to all around him simply as Kim. Born to Irish parents, he was orphaned at a young age after his mother succumbed to cholera and his father, who was a colour sergeant in the regiment of the Mavericks, fell into the vices of drink and opium and died as poor whites do in India. Leaving his son behind to struggle through life at such a young age that Kim has no memories of his parents. Though Irish by birth, Kim's skin has been burned black as any native by the blistering South Asian sun. Outside the museum, Kim encounters a Tibetan Lama of ancient years. The Lama has travelled from his native Tibetan hills on a journey to discover the mythical River of the Arrow, so that he can cleanse himself of his sins and gain enlightenment and see beyond the wheel of things. In the museum, The British curator gives the Lama a gift of paper, pencils and spectacles for the long road ahead. For the young orphaned Kim, with a natural, youthful spirit for adventure and wonder, he accepts the Lama's offer to join the aged traveller as a disciple, to aid the holy man on his spiritual quest. In exchange, the old man will support young Kim in his quest to find a red bull on a green field, as his late father had once promised. 900 first-class devils, whose god was a red bull on a green field, would attend to Kim. With knowledge of his father's wishes, Kim is drawn to it like prophecy, and wishes to discover the destiny his father had wished for him. Their journey agreed, Kim quickly manages to use his knowledge of the streets to find some food. Kim leads the Lama to the Kashmir Sarai, where he seeks food from Mobab Ali, a Pashtun horse trader and, though unknown to Kim at present, a British spy. Kim often runs errands for him, and Ali is very protective of him, calling Kim a friend of all the world. Ali gives Kim a folded report of a British intelligence operative to deliver to Colonel Crichton in Umballa, revealing a conspiracy involving 5 confederated kings, Russia, a Hindu banker, Belgian gunmakers, and a Mohammedan ruler. Before setting out, Kim witnesses spies searching amongst Ali's belongings. The Lama and Kim board a train to Umballa, which is a new experience for the frail Lama. As the two travel, they have many conversations with people from across the great profusion of cultures and castes of Indian society. Reaching Umballa, a kind woman shelters the Lama while Kim delivers a message to Crichton by tossing it onto his veranda. Crichton discusses a report with his aides, and they set about preparing 8,000 men for punishment. Kim overhears these plans, and then reunites with the Lama. The two companions travel along the Grand Trunk Road, encountering more diverse Indians, Brahmins, bankers, pilgrims, and many more. They rest at a local Pareo, where a grand lady in a bullock wagon asks the Lama to bless her and accompany her entourage. Sheltering in a grove, they see a British regiment with a Red Bull flag on green. All at once, Kim is overcome with thoughts of his father's words. Sneaking in to investigate, Kim is caught by the Anglican chaplain Bennett and interrogated by the Catholic Father Victor, both of whom treat Kim with great curiosity. About Kim's neck, hidden within a locket, they find documents of his parentage, revealing Kim to them to be the regiment's orphan son. Despite Kim's intense protestations, the priests separate him from the Lama, who departs lamenting the loss of his guide. The regiment returns to Umballa barracks. For Kim, who has lived a life of unrestrained autonomy until now, he is forced into uniform and education, learning about the British standards of discipline, order, and character. He also endures beatings and slurs from the drummer boys. Resolved to escape, he sends a letter to Mahbub Ali and is rescued by him, but Crichton intervenes. Colonel Crichton is a man of good morals, sensible pragmatism, and effective administration. He arranges for Kim's education at St. Xavier's in Lucknow, to be funded by the Lama, who still sees young Kim as his disciple on their quest to find the River of the Arrow. The colonel tells Kim in good faith that, "They'll make a man of you, O'Hara, at St. Xavier's. A white man. And, I hope, a good man." This forceful thrusting into the white man's world sends Kim into an identity crisis. Kim lit a rank cigarette. He had been careful to buy a stock in the bazaar, and lay down to think. This solitary passage was very different from that joyful down journey in the third class with the Lama.
"Sahibs get little pleasure of travel," he reflected. "Hai mai, I go from one place to another as it might be a kickball. It is my kismet. No man can escape his kismet. But I am to pray to Bibi Miriam, and I am a sahib."
He looked at his boots ruefully.
"No, I am Kim. This is a great world, and I am only Kim. Who is Kim?"
He considered his own identity, a thing that he had never done before, till his head swam. He was one insignificant person in all this roaring whirl of India, going southward to he knew not what fate. Kim travels by train to Lucknow, very conscious of his incompatibility with the British men around him. Upon arriving at the new school, Kim is unexpectedly reunited with the Lama, who has journeyed to see him.
I acquire merit in that I help thee, my chela, to wisdom. The priest of that body of men who serve the Red Bull wrote me that all should be as I desired for thee. I sent the money to suffice for 1 year, and then I came, as thou seest me, to watch for thee going up to the gates of learning. A day and a half have I waited, not because I was led by any affection towards thee, that is no part of the way, but money having been paid for learning, it was right that I should oversee the end of the matter. They resolved my doubts most clearly. I had a fear that, perhaps, I came because I wished to see thee, misguided by the red mist of affection. It is not so.
The Lama assures Kim that he will write and visit where he can. 3 years pass at St. Xavier's, and Kim learns amongst many diverse youths. They were sons of subordinate officials in the railway, telegraph and canal services, of warrant officers, sometimes retired and sometimes acting as commanders-in-chief in the feudatory Raja's army, of captains of the Indian Marine Government pensioners, planters, presidency shopkeepers, and missionaries. A few were cadets of the old Eurasian houses that had taken strong root in Durham Tola, Pereiras, De Souzas, and De Silvas. Their parents could well have educated them in England, but they loved the school that had served their own youth. And generation followed sallow-hued generation at St. Xavier's. During the holidays, Kim spies with Mahbub Ali, visiting many cities and gaining his first experience at sea, and of the sickness it churned within his stomach. He also meets with Lurgan, a seller of gems. Under Lurgan's tutelage, Kim is initiated into the world of spycraft through memory games and disguises. The Indian child played this game clumsily. That little mind, keen as an icicle where tally of jewels was concerned, could not temper itself to enter another soul. But a demon in Kim woke up and sang with joy as he put on the changing dresses and changed speech and gesture therewith. Like many of the older men around him, Lurgan sees tremendous potential in the boy, who is now becoming a young man. From time to time, God causes men to be born, and thou art one of them, who have a lust to go abroad at the risk of their lives and discover news. Today it may be of far-off things. Tomorrow, of some hidden mountain, and the next day of some nearby men who have done a foolishness against the state. These souls are very few, and of these few, not more than 10 are of the best. Crichton, Mahbub Ali, and Lurgan discuss Kim's future in the Secret Service. Kim's early life has given him a natural proficiency for espionage, and the colonel is keen to use his new asset in the great game against Russia. It is decided that Kim will be granted 6 months to wander with his old companion, the Tibetan Lama, so that the young man may complete his education and allow him to fulfill his obligations to the old man, before preparing him for the life of service to Britain. As a rite of passage into his adulthood, and in recognition of Kim as a kind of surrogate son, Mahbub Ali gifts Kim a revolver, and then takes the young man to see Hanifa, a blind practitioner of Oriental sorcery. The room, with its dirty cushions and half-smoked hookahs, smelt abominably of stale tobacco. In one corner lay a huge and shapeless woman, clad in greenish gauzes, and decked brow, nose, ear, neck, wrist, arm, waist, and ankle with heavy native jewellery. When she turned, it was like the clashing of copper pots. Among the smog of incense and drugs, Hanifa employs her rituals and powders to protect Kim on his quest. His skin darkened and his soul fortified against untold evils, Kim speaks to the Babu, Hari Chunder.
The Babu is portly proportioned and seemingly quite stupid. Kim struggles to conceive of how such a man can be capable of spy work. But make no mistake, the Babu is an indispensable ally of Britain. As he is about to board the train for Benares, where the Lama awaits a now educated and budding agent, Kim drew a deep breath and hugged himself all over. The nickel-plated revolver he could feel in the bosom of his sad-coloured robe. The amulet was on his neck. Begging gourd, rosary and ghost dagger, Mr. Logan had forgotten nothing, were all to hand, with medicine, paint box and compass, and in a worn old purse belt embroidered with porcupine quill patterns lay a month's pay. Kings could be no richer. At long last, Kim is alone again, and his identity crisis weighs on him once more. Orphan of Indian Lahore, son of Irish parents, agent of British intelligence, and a man who changes faiths and fashions as fluidly as his work demands. Who is Kim? Deep in his ruminations, Kim is approached by a long-haired Hindu Biragi.
"I have also lost it," he said sadly. "It is one of the gates to the way, but for me it has been shut many years."
"What is the talk?" said Kim, abashed.
"Thou wast wondering there in thy spirit what manner of thing thy soul might be. The seizure came of a sudden, I know. Who should know but I? Whither goest thou?"
"Toward Kashi."
"There are no gods there. I have proved them. I go to Prayag for the fifth time, seeking the road to enlightenment."
"Go in hope, little brother," he said.
"It is a long road to the feet of the One, but thither do we all travel."
Arriving in the ancient city of Benares, Kim is accompanied by a chance-met Punjabi farmer, a Kambo from Jalandhar way, who had appealed in vain to every god of his homestead to cure his small son, and was trying Benares as a last resort. Eager to embark on the quest to find the River of the Arrow, began so many years ago, Kim reunites with the Lama at the Jayan Temple. The Lama has waited, guided by dreams. He cures a child's fever with quinine, much to the Jat father's deep gratitude and relief, and the Lama recounts the events of his recent years to his old ally.
"I was but waiting for thee. It was made plain to me in 100 dreams, notably one that came upon the night of the day that the gates of learning first shut, that without thee I should never find my river. Again and again, as thou knowest, I put this from me, fearing an illusion. Therefore, I would not take thee with me that day at Lucknow, when we ate the cakes. I would not take thee till the time was ripe and auspicious. From the hills to the sea, from the sea to the hills have I gone, but it was vain. Then I remembered the Jataka."
He told Kim the story of the elephant with the leg iron, as he had told it so often to the Jayan priests.
"Further testimony is not needed," he ended serenely. "Thou wast sent for an aid. That aid removed, my search came to naught. Therefore, we will go out again together, an hour search sure."
"Whither go we?"
"What matters, friend of all the world? The search, I say, is sure. If need be, the river will break from the ground before us. I acquired merit when I sent thee to the gates of learning and gave thee the jewel that is wisdom. Thou didst return. I saw even now a follower of Sakyamuni, the physician, whose altars are many in Botayal. It is sufficient. We are together, and all things are as they were, friend of all the world, friend of the stars. My Chela."
They head north by train. During their transit, Kim meets another of Khaitan's agents, known only as E23.
If you enjoyed this piece of premium content from the Lotus Eaters, head to our website where you can find more.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.